the organizer and the conference for the opportunity to present here. I am also an outsider. I work with trees, but not ornamental trees, forest trees. I do take pleasure in connecting the team members. I remember a couple years ago, I actually have a pet project on tree pollen transcriptomics. So I think I emailed Bob and Phil for dogwood pollen, got introduced to Tim and Jenny, and we start having a conversation talking about collaboration, and we need a genome. Nobody feel comfortable to lead a genome sequencing project. I said, I know who to contact. I call up Jim and say, hey, Jim, you know, this is an asterisk underrepresented in the JGI collection. So our fearless leader took it up and got an NSF genome project, and 3 years later, we have a genome, a draft genome now. So it's really wonderful. I do... I'm here to share with you our work with CRISPR genome editing. I assume that most of you have heard about CRISPR genome editing, the newest genome engineering method, so I will briefly talk about the basic and then share with you our work with a highly heterozygous, non-sequenced popular genotype, the challenge that we face. I'll go through some case study with individual genes and duplicated genes and all the way to tandem gene array if I have time, and then some of the emerging trends. So this is a single slide to summarize how CRISPR-Cas9 work. So this is actually a bacteria archaea defense system. So those cells, when they are attacked by phages or plasmids or viruses, they have the ability to recognize invading DNAs, the colored DNA, and chop them into small pieces and incorporate some of those fragments into their own genome as those blocks or spacers, if you will, the colored blocks here. So blue came from the blue and green from this stage. In between repeat sequence. So this is what is called CRISPR array. And once this locus is transcribed to produce RNA, the genes encoded in the same locus, the so-called CRISPR-associated proteins, will process them into small RNA. And those small RNA carry those spacer, color spacers, will then recognize future invading enemies. So the blue guy will actually guide the small CRISPR RNA to recognize blue DNA and degrade them and then become basically immune to the future defense. So it's really simple system. The only thing that you need is the array sequence shown here, so-called protospacer adjacent motif or PAM. Only needs three in this particular system, only needs three nucleotides, NGG. Any nucleotide with 2G, that's good enough to trigger the whole system. So in biotechnological sense, it's super simple, means it's really powerful. All you need is in a binary vector, we use agrobacteria. So in the binary vector, in addition to the typical antibiotic selectable genes, all you need to have is the Cas9 nuclease that cleave the DNA. And because this editing happened in the nucleus, so you need to attach a nuclear localization signal to direct the translated protein into the nucleus. And so this whole thing, we use a human codon optimized Cas9 driven by double certified promoter. And then the other piece is the small CRISPR RNA, the guide RNA. It's only 20 nucleotides long. You use a small U6 small RNA promoters that usually is being used to drive small RNA like microRNA and guide RNA in this case. And so you just need to pick 20 nucleotides in the gene that you want to target, as long as it's immediately upstream of NGG, okay? So in this case, this vector was constructed by Tom Jacobs, a former student of WAM parent, because they work in soybeans, so obviously it's the reason why he picked an alfalfa U6 promoter. So Tom talked me into actually testing this in populace, and he offered to make the vector for us. So this was 4 years ago. I thought, well, sure, why not? If somebody is going to offer their help, all I needed to do at that time was to pick my favorite gene. So I have worked on this complex phenylpropanoid pathway for many years. So I decided to go back to my old love, if you will. So I turned the figure 90 degrees. You can't really read it, but this is the gene that we target. It's for CLO4 chimerical coenzyme A ligase. It basically converts these phenolic acid, pyrochromic acid into its thiol-CoA esters. And this intermediate is then channeled into either lignin or flavonoids and anthocyanins, either for structural support or pigmentation. So we have studied this gene family for many years. In all angiosperms, this is a multi-gene family. You got multiple copies. In poplars, we got 6 copies. 5 in so-called class 1 and a single member in so-called class 2. So we have known since before genome was sequenced, this group including lignin biosynthetic pathway specific isoforms, especially for CL1, it's highly expressed in lignin fine tissues. Class 2 is thought to be involved in anthocyanin pigment biosynthesis. But actually, even in the rhabdopsis, genetic evidence wasn't there. So we and several others have shown that by knocking out class 1 for CL, you can actually reduce lignin content. So we decided to basically target 3 genes, targeting for CL1 as a proof of concept because we knew it worked. So then we can test whether or not CRISPR works better than antisense RNAi and sense code suppression. And then you see the 2 genes here, for CL1 and for CL2, are genome duplicates. So they are highly, highly similar. And this allows us to test for CRISPR specificity and functional redundancy. And then we did for CL2, but I don't have time to talk about for CL2 today. So picking the gene was sort of easy. Designing the guide RNA wasn't so straightforward then, because we're really lucky to have a reference genome in populace. Populous trichocarpa genome was sequenced. What's the first 3 genome to be sequenced, the 3rd plant genome to be sequenced. But right here, this is Populous trichocarpa. For those of us working on functional elucidation in populous, we often use this European so-called 717, trimulized by ALBA hybrid aspen because it's super easy to transform. So if you want to study gene function, I don't want to spend a year to produce transgenic, right? As quick as we can, but you can see this phylogenetic relationship. Aspens and cottonwoods are as far apart as you can get. So you can see the morphology difference and all that. We have always known, you know, designing primers and those kind of things could be tricky if you take the reference genome sequence working on a different species. So at that time, Tom and I, we just basically manually identify the probe. So here's the NGG and then 20 nucleotides, preferably having the G layer. So we target the first exons for the probe, and then I basically manually check our in-house RNA-seq to make sure that we don't run into SNPs. So all the tick marks that you see here, those are sequence variation. So I worry that they could actually compromise CRISPR, so we avoided that. And then a visiting student, Xiaohong Zhao from Nanjing Forestry University, visited the lab, and she has a lot of experience in tissue culture, so I gave her this side project. She did a really good job producing more than 30 independent transgenic events from each one of the fossil 1, fossil 2, fossil 5, and then case 9 control vector construct. That day when she did her first sampling, she almost had a panic attack because she, you know, peel the bark, we want to do lignin, right? She saw brown stain, and she saw she did something wrong to the plants. The plants were sick because they looked like this. And for me, it's like, yes, this is lignin reduction. Some of you probably know the brown midrib, sorghums, and maize. Any lignin modification, often you get side effect with stem discoloration. So it was really exciting because every single transgenic line she generated, and we have 30-some transgenic lines, every single one of them had brown color through and through entire stem. And this was really amazing because I did my PhD in the old-fashioned way. Back then, antisense and sense co-suppression, RNAi, and if you're lucky, you get some silencing effect, and the coloration that you see here, it's mosaic, it's incomplete. If you have silencing in that sector, you see the color. Only out of 50-some plants back then I generated, only one give me the complete coloration. But with CRISPR, every single one we generated was, you know, totally discolored. So we knew there was the eureka moment that we knew CRISPR works really well. We didn't even need to do molecular work, but to publish, we know we need to prove, right? So this is my reminder to show you that the enzyme will actually act like a pair of scissors to cut a double-stranded DNA both strands. So you generate double-stranded break. That break is then repaired by non-homologous end joining system. So basically, you're just trying to stitch the two ends together by introducing, you know, small insertion or deletion, and that basically will throw off the reading frame, and so you will have mutated protein. So we then design primers, flanking the target size, so you can basically amplify the DNA and then add barcodes, and you can multiplex, you know, 30s, hundreds of different plants and different amplicons together. So that's what we confirm. So even though we have the phenotype already, this is the NGG right here. The cleavage site usually three nucleotides upstream. And then compared to wild type and Cas9 control, you can see insertion deletion in this neighborhood. Every single plant, we only did a handful, you know, but every single one we did, we see by allelic. Two copies of the gene, both were edited. We didn't see any change in the genome duplicate for CO5, meaning the editing is very specific. We also measure lignin content, and then here again, you see a 20-some percent reduction flat line across. I have never seen any phenotype like this in any lignin work, because usually you see a gradient. You know, if you're lucky, a few lines might have reduction, but here you can do any lottery join, any single one that you pick, they are essentially the same. But it did show that we have no mutation for the key gene, but we only knock out lignin by 20%. Suggesting some functional redundancy. So we thought that duplicated gene for CL5 would be the guy, but the experiment failed. We generated 30-some transgenic plants and did the amplicon sequencing, and nothing got edited. So I blame Tom, Tom blame me. At that time, we were doing manual probe selection and all that, and we just picked the wrong one. And so we thought this is what we wanted, but this is the reference genome. This is the 7172 alleles, single nucleotide variation in each case. And that was enough to basically throw off the system. So it was negative, but it actually proved just how specific the CRISPR system works. So it's actually very assuring in that case. So my bioinformatician basically saw this struggle with those kind of manual work. He decided to take advantage of some resequencing data we have for 717. And basically use publicly available programs to call SNPs or indels. And then because we couldn't really assemble a reasonable genome with that level of sequencing, he decided to basically just borrow the idea from 1001 Arabidopsis genome, which is substitute the SNPs to the reference genome to create what we call substitute 717 or S717 genome. So we use that and then ask the questions, how often does guide RNA design run into SNPs or indels in the reference genome? So for that, we randomly sample 1,000 genes and then use publicly available program to design 10 guide RNA with some sort of quantity score. And then we did this with the reference genome, with 717 genome. And in all genome, if you browse the genome browser, usually it's like single allele pseudogenome. Right? They don't even show you the two different alleles. So then we take the information and compare it to our variant database. And this is what happened with the reference genome. So if you design your probe using the reference genome and compare to 717 variant DB, more than half of the time, you're going to run into the region that got SNPs or indels. So that means more than, you know, half of the time, if you do that tissue culture experiment transformation, you're going to fail because you're going to have SNPs there. If you use the 717 genome for the design, the frequency is reduced, but still, 40% of the time, you might actually fail in the experiment. So this is the challenge with any outcrossing species. We have the pipeline. This is actually specifically for populace, but for those of you working on outcrossing species, our algorithm design should be applicable. We also have a software for analyzing genome editing patterns by sequencing that I don't have time to talk about. But I want to just, again, emphasizing that compared to the traditional gene silencing approach, you need to know where the gene is expressed to select the right promoter to target the genes. And then you go through this lengthy process of creating many different transgenic events, screening for the best performers and do propagation and all that. With CRISPR, you can actually do the amplicon sequencing at the tissue culture stage, and then identify the ones that have the kind of mutation editing patterns you want. And then because I show you the uniformity of the phenotypes, you can use those primary transformers directly in your phenotypic analysis and characterization. So it's huge time saving. That's what I call it, the CRISPR speedway. So I'll just show you a couple of key points here. Not only that CRISPR generate indel mutation to throw off the protein translation, if you target the guide RNA in the first exon, in the multi-exon gene, you will also trigger the so-called nonsense-mediated mRNA decay, and then basically you don't get transcription either. And then I show you already on the phenotypic uniformity in metabolomics, the technical variation usually is so high, but we see very clear separation of the mutant and the wild type. And then the other thing is about specificity to check the redundancy. So we went back to check for CL5. This is a minor form, and this time we succeeded in editing the particular gene, but we found no change whatsoever in ligand. So you have the case of knocking out for CL1, 20% reduction, knocking out for CL5, no reduction. So we decided to target them both. In this case, both were targeted, and we did succeed in editing both genes, but some plants were really unhappy. If you take away lignin, plants cannot survive. They die within a week. Although a few actually survived, you can see here, and those few that have survived were the last three that have in-frame mutation. So this become really powerful because we actually can turn two genes, duplicates into four alleles, and then you have editing mutation of a weak gene, a strong gene, or three out of the four, or in this case, actually both gene knockout. And it's really amazing, there's no lignin, so there's no staining of lignin in pink color, but they continue to actually produce wood, if you will. So this is, you know, you can imagine, I'm showing you as lignin, but this could be flower color, disease, you actually can get those response there. I guess I don't have time to talk about this. I thought I still have 3 minutes. But this is a really complex tendon duplication array that we ran into a redox protein. So it's 8 copies. We actually managed to find an probe that we can target all 8 copies, but it turned out to be really, really complicated. The two species, Trichocarpa and 717, has different patterns. It turned out that we actually have huge deletion, a big chunk of the chromosome being dropout. If you make 2 cuts, you can actually drop out a whole chunk, and in this case, it seems to be multiplexed cut editing as well. But it makes wet lab and dry lab data analysis highly, highly challenging. So I'm just going to zip through. I told you a lot about creating mutants, but CRISPR is also very good on basically inserting a gene at the spot that you want. But in plants and animals, actually, this requires homology-directed repair, which is highly, highly inefficient. So that means we have to get back to tissue culture transformation. 0.8%, you can do flower dip with Arabidopsis. I can't find anybody who wants to do transformation with 1,000 leaf discs to get like 8 events, right? So it won't work. So this is why I'm so excited about this DuPont technology. Induced embryogenesis, supposed to be like genotype independent with mates, inbred lines that can actually get from initiation to plants to the greenhouse, they say, in 4 or 5 weeks. So this has high potential. And then finally, I guess this audience, you already know with horticultural practice, you can do induced flowering and get to the next generation. With forest trees, that has been very difficult. But because of biallelic mutation, now you can actually combine it with FT or flowering in one single crosses. You can get transgene-free mutants that should alleviate regulatory issues and all that. So I guess I'll skip the summary. You know the drill. I just want to show you these 30-some genome-edited organisms in this beautiful palette. Every single thing here is genome-edited, except for NG Edabali here. This is my high school intern who helped me put in these beautiful palettes together. So with that, I'll just thank people and collaborators and other people's work I don't even have time to talk about. And then finally, just a plug for our graduate program at UGM, multi-college, multiple study areas. And then I'm looking for a postdoc in populace genome editing if you're interested in it. Thank you.